Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents The Clockwork Century by Sherry Priest. Narrated by Colleen Delaney. With performances by Matthew Bassett, Christopher Graybill, Gabriella Fernandez-Coffey, Helen Pufumi, Andy Clements, Evan Casey, and Bradley Smith. The Clockwork Century, Tanglefoot.
Stonewall Jackson survived Chancellorsville. England broke the Union's naval blockade and formally recognized the Confederate States of America. Atlanta never burned. It is 1880. The American Civil War has raged for nearly two decades, driving technology in strange and terrible directions. Combat dirigibles skulk across the sky, and armored vehicles crawl along the land. Military scientists twist the laws of man and nature and barter their souls for weapons powered by light, fire, and steam. But life struggles forward for soldiers and ordinary citizens. The fractured nation is dotted with stricken towns and epic scenes of devastation, some man-made and some more mysterious. In the Western territories, cities are swallowed by gas and walled away to rot, while the frontiers are strip-mined for resources. On the borders between North and South, spies scour and scheme, and smugglers build economies more stable than their governments. This is the Clockwork Century. It is dark here, and different.
Oh, what was it?
Hunkered shoulders and skinny, bent knees cast a crooked shadow from the back corner of the laboratory, where the old man tried to remember the next step in his formula. Or possibly, as young Edwin was forced to consider, the scientist simply struggled to recall his own name. On the table against the wall, the once estimable Dr. Archibald Smeeks muttered to no one but himself.
That? Doctor?
The doctor steadied himself and crouched on his stool, cringing away from the boy's voice.
Who's there?
Only me, sir.
Who?
Me. It's only me.
The orphan?
Yes, sir. Just the orphan.
Dr. Smeeks turned around. He reached to his forehead where a prodigious set of multi-lensed goggles was perched. From the left side, he tugged a monocle to extend it on a hinged metal arm, and he used it to peer across the room, down onto the floor, where Edwin was sitting cross-legged in a pile of discarded machinery parts.
Oh, there you are, yes. I didn't hear you tinkering, and I only wondered where you might be hiding. Of course I remember you.
I believe you do, sir. I didn't mean to interrupt your work. You sounded upset. I wanted to ask if everything was all right.
All right? Oh, yes, everything's quite all right. I think for a moment that I was distracted.
Dr. Smeeks returned his monocle to its original position so that it no longer shrank his fluffy white eyebrow down to a tame and reasonable arch. He scooted around on the stool so that he once again faced the cluttered table with its vials, coils, and tiny gray crucibles. His right hand selected a test tube with a hand-lettered label and runny green contents. His left hand reached for a set of tongs, though he set them aside almost immediately in favor of a half-rolled piece of paper that bore the stains and streaks of 100 unidentifiable splatters.
Edwin, boy, could you join me for a moment? I'm afraid I've gone and confused myself.
Yes, sir.
Edwin lived in the basement by the grace of Dr. Smeeks, who had asked the sanitarium for an assistant. These days, the old fellow could not remember requesting such an arrangement and could scarcely confirm or deny it anymore, no matter how often Edwin reminded him. Therefore, Edwin made a point to keep himself useful. The basement laboratory come living quarters was a quieter home than the crowded group ward on the top floor where the children of the patients were kept and raised, and the boy didn't mind the doctor's failing mental state, since what was left of him was kind and often friendly, and sometimes, in a glimmering flash between moments of pitiful bewilderment, Edwin saw the doctor for who he once had been. A brilliant man with a mind that was honored and admired for its flexibility and prowess. In its way, the Waverly Hills Sanitarium was a testament to Smeek's outstanding imagination. The hospital had incorporated many of the doctor's creations into the daily routine of the patients, including a kerosene-powered bladed machine that whipped fresh air down the halls to offset the oppressive summer heat. The physicians had also integrated Dr. Smeek's moving mechanical doors that opened with the push of a switch, and his wonderful steam-powered dish cleaning device was a huge hit in the kitchen. His sheet-sorting slings made Smeeks a celebrity in the laundry rooms, and the sanitary rotating manure chutes had made him a demigod to the stable hands. But half-finished and barely finished inventions littered every corner and covered every table in the basement, where the famed and elderly genius lived out the last of his years. So long as he did not remember how much he'd forgotten, he appeared content. Edwin approached the doctor's side and peered dutifully at the stained schematics on the discolored piece of linen paper, notes he'd only drawn a day or two before.
It's coming along nicely, sir.
I'm forced to agree with you, my lad. Could you tell me what it was I was working on? Suddenly the numbers aren't speaking to me. Which project was I addressing, do you know?
These are the notes for your therapeutic bath appliance. Those numbers to the right are your guesses for the most healthful solution of water, salt, and lavender. You were collecting lemongrass.
Lemongrass? I was going to put that in the water? Whatever would have possessed me to do such a thing?
You'd been reading about Dr. Kellogg's hydrotherapy treatments in Battle Creek, and you felt that you could improve on them.
Battle Creek! Yes, the sanitarium there. Good Christian folks, they keep a strict diet. It seems to work well for the patients, or so the literature on the subject suggests. But yes, I remember. There must be a more efficient way to warm the water and make it more pleasing to the senses. The soothing qualities of lavender have been documented for thousands of years, and its antiseptic properties should help keep the water fresh. Doesn't that sound nice?
I don't really like to take baths. But if the water was warm and it smelled real nice, I think I'd like it better.
It'd be less for the purposes of cleanliness and more for the therapy of the inmates here. Some of the more restless or violent ones, you understand?
Yes, sir.
And how's your mother? Has she responded well to treatment? I heard her coughing last night, and I was wondering if I couldn't concoct a syrup that might give her comfort.
You must have heard someone else.
Perhaps you're right.
Dr. Smeeks returned his attention to the notes and lines on the brittle sheet before him. Edwin did not tell Dr. Smeeks for the fifth or sixth time that his mother had been dead for months. He'd learned that it was easier to agree and probably kinder as well. It became apparent that the old man's attention had been reabsorbed by his paperwork and test tubes, so Edwin returned to his stack of mechanical refuse. He was almost 11 years old, and he'd lived in the basement with the doctor for nearly a year. In that time, he'd learned quite a lot about how a carefully fitted gear can turn and how a pinpoint-sharp mind can rust. And he took what scraps he wanted to build his own toys, trinkets, and machines. After all, it was half the pleasure and privilege of living away from the other children. He could help himself to anything the doctor did not immediately require. He didn't like the other children much. And the feeling was mutual. The other offspring of the unfortunate residents were loud and frantic. They believed Edwin was aloof when he was only absorbed in thought, and they treated him badly when he wished to be left alone. All things considered, a cot beside a boiler in a room full of metal and chemicals was a significant step up in the world, and the fractured mind of the gentle old man was more companionable by far than the boys and girls who baked themselves daily on the roof, playing ball and beating one another while the orderlies weren't looking. Even so, Edwin had long suspected he could do better. Maybe he couldn't find better, but he was increasingly confident that he could make better. Edwin turned a pair of old bolts over in his palm and concluded that they were solid enough beneath their grime that a bit of sandpaper would restore their luster and usefulness. All the gears and coils he needed were already stashed and assembled, but some details yet eluded him, and his new friend was not quite finished, not until it boasted the finer angles of a human face. Already, Edwin had bartered a bit of the doctor's throat remedy to a taxidermist, an act which gained him two brown eyes meant for a badger. Instead, these eyes were fitted in a pounded brass mask with a cut strip of tin that made a sloping nose. The face was coming together, but the bottom jaw was not connected, so the facsimile was not yet whole. Edwin held the bolts up to his eye to inspect their threadings.
These will work.
Yeah?
Nothing, sir. I'm going to go back to my cot and tinker.
Well, very good, then. Enjoy yourself, Parker. Summon me if you need an extra hand.
That's what Smeeks always said when Edwin announced that he intended to try his own small hands at inventing. Parker was the youngest son of Dr. and Mrs. Smeeks. Edwin had seen him once when he'd come to visit a year before at Christmas. The thin man with a fretful face had brought a box of clean new vials and a large pad of lined paper, plus a gas-powered burner that had been made in Germany. But his father's confusion was too much for him. He'd left, and he hadn't returned. So if Dr. Smeeks wanted to call Edwin Parker once in a while, that was fine. Like Parker himself, Edwin was also thin, with a face marked by worry beyond his years, and Edwin was also handy with pencils, screwdrivers, and wrenches. The boy figured that the misunderstanding was understandable, if unfortunate, and he learned to answer to the other name when it was used to call him. Edwin took his old bolts back to his cot and picked up a tiny triangle of sandpaper. Beside him, at the foot of his cot underneath the wool blanket, lay a lump in the shape of a boy, perhaps half Edwin's size. The lump was not a doll, but an automaton, ready to wind, but not wound yet, not until it had a proper face with a proper jaw. When the bolts were as clean as the day they were cast, Edwin placed them gently on his pillow and reached inside the hat box Mrs. Williams had given him. He withdrew the steel jawbone and examined it, comparing it against the bolts and deciding that the fit was satisfactory, and then he uncovered the boy-shaped lump.
Good heavens, Edwin. What have you got there?
Sir, it's a machine. I made it.
You made this?
Yes, sir. Just with odds and ends. Things you weren't using. I hope you don't mind.
Mind? No, I don't mind. Dear boy, it's exceptional.
You think it's good?
I think it must be. How does it work? Do you crank it or...
It winds up. One of your old hex wrenches will do it.
Edwin rolled the automaton over onto its back and pointed at a hole that was barely large enough to hold a pencil. Dr. Smeeks turned the small machine over again, looking into the tangle of gears and loosely fixed coils where the brains would be. He touched its oiled joints and the clever little pistons that must surely work for muscles.
When you wind it, what does it do?
Sir, I'm not sure. I haven't wound him yet.
Haven't wound him? Well, I suppose that's excuse enough. I see that you've taken my jaw lids for kneecaps, and that's well and good. It's a good fit. He's made to walk a bit, isn't he?
He ought to be able to walk, but I don't think he can climb stairs. I haven't tested him. I was waiting until I finished his face.
Edwin held up the metal jawbone in one hand and the two shiny bolts in the other.
I'm almost done.
Oh, do it then. How exciting. It's your first invention, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Oh, go on. Do you mind if I observe? I'm always happy to watch the success of a fellow colleague.
No, sir. And thank you. Here, if you could hold him for me. Like that, on your legs, yes. I'll take the bolts and just...
With trembling fingers, Edwin fastened the final hardware and dabbed the creases with oil from a half-empty can. And he was finished. Edwin took the automaton from Dr. Smeeks and stood it upright on the floor, where the machine did not wobble or topple, but stood fast and gazed blankly wherever its face was pointed.
It's a handsome machine you've made. What does it do again? I don't recall.
I still need to wind it. I need an L-shaped key. Do you have one?
Dr. Smeeks jammed his hands into the baggy depths of his pockets.
No. Will this work?
Let me see.
Edwin inserted the hex key into the hole and gave it a twist. Encouraged, Edwin continued. It felt as if he'd spent forever winding when finally he could twist no further. The boy removed the hex key and stood up straight. On the automaton's back, behind the place where its left shoulder blade ought to be, there was a sliding switch. Edwin put his finger to it and gave the switch a tiny shove. Edwin and the doctor watched with delight as the clockwork boy's arms lifted and went back down to its sides. One leg rose at a time, and each was returned to the floor in a charming parody of marching in place. its boltwork neck turned from left to right, causing its tinted glass eyes to sweep the room.
It works! Parker, I swear you've done a most excellent job. And with what? My leftovers. Is that what you said?
Yes, sir. That's what I said. You remembered.
Oh, of course I remembered. I remember you. What will you call your new toy?
He's my new friend. And I'm going to call him Ted.
Ted.
Yes.
Edwin did not explain that he'd once had a baby brother named Theodore, or that Theodore had died before his first birthday. This was something different, and anyway, it didn't matter what he told Dr. Smeeks, who wouldn't long recall it.
Well, he's very fine indeed. You should take him upstairs and show him to Mrs. Criddle and Mrs. Williams. Oh, you should absolutely show him to your mother. I think she'll be pleased.
Yes, sir. I will, sir.
Your mother will be proud, and I'm proud. You're learning so much, so fast. One day I think you should go to school. A bright boy like you shouldn't hide in basements with old men like me. A head like yours is a commodity, son, not a thing to be wasted.
To emphasize his point, he ruffled Edwin's hair as he walked away. Edwin sat on the edge of his cot, which brought him to eye level with the automaton. He felt an ineffable bond with his creation, unlike any he'd ever known.
Ted?
Ted's jaw opened and closed, but the mechanical child had no lungs nor lips, and it did not speak. The flesh and blood boy picked up Ted and carried him carefully under his arm up the stairs. Edwin entered the main body of the Waverly Hills Sanitarium. The first floor offices and corridors were mostly safe and mostly empty, or populated by the bustling, concentrating men with clipboards and glasses and very bland smiles that recognized Edwin without caring that he was present. The sanitarium was very new. Some of its halls were freshly built and still stinking of mortar and the dust of construction. Its top floor rooms reeked faintly of paint and lead, as well as the medicines and bandages of the ill and the mad. Edwin avoided the top floors where the other children lived, and he avoided the wards of the men who were kept in jackets and chains. He also avoided the sick wards, where the madmen and women were tended to. Mrs. Criddle and Mrs. Williams worked in the kitchen and laundry, respectively, and they looked like sisters, though they were not, in fact, related. Both were women of a stout and purposeful build, with great tangles of graying hair tied up in buns and covered in sanitary hair caps. And both women were the mothering sort, who were stern with patients, but kind to the hapless orphans who milled from floor to floor when they weren't organized and contained on the roof. Edwin found Mrs. Criddle first, working a paddle through a metal vat of mashed potatoes that was large enough to hold the boy, Ted, and a third friend of comparable size. Her wide bottom rocked from side to side with the sweep of her elbows as she stirred the vat.
Mrs. Criddle?
Yes, dear.
It's Edwin, ma'am.
Of course it is.
Mrs. Criddle leaned the paddle against the side of the vat and flipped a lever to lower the fire.
Hello there, boy. It's not time for supper, but what have you got there?
Edwin held Ted forward so she could inspect his new invention.
His name is Ted. I made him.
Ted. Oh, yes. Ted, that's a good name for a new friend.
That's right. He's my new friend. Watch, he can walk. Look at what he can do.
Edwin pressed the switch. The clockwork boy marched in place. Then it staggered forward, catching itself with every step. Ted moved forward until it knocked its forehead on the leg of a counter, then stopped and turned to the left to continue soldiering onward.
Oh, would you look at that? That's amazing is what that is. He just turned around like that, just like he knew.
He's automatic.
Automatic indeed. Very nice, love. But Mr. Bird and Miss Emmy will be here in a few minutes, and the kitchen will be a busy place for a boy and his new friend. You'd best take him back downstairs.
First, I want to go show Mrs. Williams.
Oh, no, dear. I think you'd better not. She's upstairs with the other boys and girls, and, well, I suppose you know. I think you're better off down with Dr. Smeeks.
If I take him upstairs, they'll only break him, won't they?
I think they're likely to try.
All right.
Come back in another hour, will you? You can get your own supper and carry the doctors while you're at it.
Yes, ma'am, I will.
With Ted under his arm, Edwin retreated back down the pristine corridors and dodged between two empty gurneys. Then he went back down the stairs that would return him to the safety of the doctor, the laboratory, and his own cot. He made his descent quietly so as not to disturb the doctor in case he was still working. When Edwin peeked around the bottom corner, he saw the old scientist sitting on his stool once more, a wadded piece of linen paper crushed in his fist. A spilled test tube leaked runny gray liquid across the counter's top and made a dark stain across the doctor's pants. The shadow of Edwin's head crept across the wall, and when the doctor spotted it, he stopped himself and sat up straighter.
Parker, I've had a little spill. It's a bit of a mess.
Do you need any help, sir?
Help? I suppose I don't. If I only knew. If I could only remember.
The doctor slid down off the stool, stumbling as his foot clipped the seat's bottom rung.
Parker, where's the window? Didn't we have a window?
Edwin took the old man's arm and guided him over to his bed, in a nook at the far end of the laboratory.
Sir, I think you should lie down. Mrs. Criddle says supper comes in an hour. You just lie down, and I'll bring it to you when it's ready.
Supper?
Ugh. Edwin sat Dr. Smeeks on the edge of his bed and removed the man's shoes, then his eyewear. He placed everything neatly beside the feather mattress and pulled the doctor's pillow to meet his downward drooping head.
I'll bring you supper when it's ready.
But Dr. Smeeks was already asleep. And in the laboratory, over by the stairs, the clockwork boy was moving itself in circles, or so Edwin assumed. He couldn't remember. Had he left Ted on the stairs? He could have sworn he'd pressed the switch to deactivate his friend, but perhaps not. Regardless, he didn't want the machine bounding clumsily around in the laboratory, not in that cluttered place, piled with glass and gadgets. Over his shoulder, Edwin glanced and saw the doctor snoozing lightly in his nook, and out in the laboratory, knocking its jar-lid knees against the bottom step, Ted had gone nowhere and harmed nothing. Edwin picked Ted up and held the creation to his face, gazing into the glass badger eyes as if they might blink back at him.
You're my friend, aren't you? Everybody makes friends. I just made you for real.
Ted's jaw dropped down, opening its mouth, so that Edwin could stare straight inside at the springs and levers that made the toy boy move. Then its jaw retracted, and without a word, Ted had set its peace. After supper, which Dr. Smeeks scarcely touched, and after an hour spent in the laundry room sharing Ted with Mrs. Williams, Edwin retreated to his cot and blew out the candle beside it. The cot wasn't wide enough for Edwin and Ted to rest side by side, but Ted fit snugly between the wall and the bedding, and Edwin left the machine there to pass the night. But the night passed fitfully, when, after much tossing and turning and muttering, the old man finally sank back into a fuller sleep. Edwin nearly followed him. Down in the basement, there were no lights except for the dim, bioluminescent glow of living solutions in blown glass beakers and the simmering wick of a hurricane lamp turned down low, but left a light enough for the boy to see his way to the privy if the urge struck him before dawn. Even upstairs, when the wee hours came, most of the inmates and patients of the sanitarium were quiet, if not by their own cycles, then by the laudanum spooned down their throats before the shades were drawn. Edwin lay on his back, his eyes closed against the faint blue and green glows from the laboratory, and he waited for slumber to call him again. He reached to his left, to the spot between his cot and the wall. He patted the small slip of space there, feeling for a manufactured arm or leg, and finding Ted's cool, unmoving form. And although there was scarcely any room, he pulled Ted out of the slot and hugged the clockwork boy into the cot after all, because, living or no, Ted was a comforting thing to hold. Morning came, and the doctor was already awake when Edwin rose.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Edwin.
On their first exchange of the day, he'd remembered the right name. Edwin tried to take it as a sign that today would be a good day, and Dr. Smeeks would mostly remain Dr. Smeeks, without toppling into the befuddled tangle of fractured thoughts and faulty recollections. The doctor was standing by the hurricane lamp, with its wick trimmed higher so that he could read. An envelope was opened and discarded beside him.
Is it a letter?
It's a letter indeed.
Is something wrong?
It depends. It's from a man who wants me to work for him.
That might be good.
No, not from this man.
You know him?
I do, and I do not care for his aims. I will not help him. Not with his terrible quests for terrible weapons. I don't do those things anymore. I haven't done them for years.
You used to make weapons? Like guns and cannons?
Once upon a time. But no more. And if Arshin thinks she can bribe or bully me, he has another thing coming. If worse comes to worst, I suppose I can plead a failing mind.
Sir?
Don't, Parker. I know why I'm here. I know things even when I can't always quite remember them. But my old colleague says he intends to pay me a visit. And he can pay me all the visits he likes. He can offer to pay me all the Union money he likes, too. Or Confederate money, or any other kind. I won't make such terrible things. Not anymore.
Smeeks folded the letter in half and struck a match to light a candle. He held one corner of the letter over the candle and let it burn until there was nothing left but the scrap between his fingertips, and then he released it, letting the smoldering flame turn even the last of the paper to ash.
Perhaps you'll catch me on a bad day. As likely as not, there'll be no need for subterfuge.
You should tell him to come in the afternoon. I hope you don't mind me saying so, sir, but you seem much clearer in the mornings.
Is that a fact? I'll take your word for it, I suppose. Lord knows I'm in no position to argue. Is that... What's that noise? It's coming from your cot. Oh, dear, I hope we haven't got a rat.
Oh, no. No, sir, that's just Ted. I must have switched him on when I got up.
What's a Ted?
It's my new friend. I made him.
There's a friend in your bunk? That doesn't seem proper.
No, he's... I'll show you.
And once again, they played the scene of discovery together, the doctor ruffling Edwin's hair and announcing that the automaton was a fine invention indeed. Edwin worked very hard to disguise his disappointment. Finally, Dr. Smeeks suggested that Edwin run to the washrooms upstairs and freshen himself to begin the day, and Edwin agreed. The boy took his spring-and-gear companion along as he navigated the corridors while the doctors and nurses made their morning rounds. Dr. Havisham paused to examine Ted and declare the creation outstanding. Dr. Martin did likewise, and Nurse Evelyn offered him a peppermint sweet for being such an innovative youngster who never made any trouble. Edwin cleaned his hands and face in one of the cold white basins in the washroom, where staff members and some of the more stable patients were allowed to refresh themselves. He sat Ted on the countertop and pressed the automaton's switch. While Edwin cleaned the night off his skin, Ted's legs kicked a friendly time against the counter, and its jaw bobbed like it was singing or chatting, or imagining splashing its feet in the basin. When he was clean, Edwin set Ted on the floor, deciding that, rather than carrying the automaton, he would simply let it walk the corridor until they reached the stairs to the basement. The peculiar pair drew more than a few stairs, but Edwin was proud of Ted, and he enjoyed the extended opportunity to show off. Before the stairs and at the edge of the corridor where Edwin wasn't supposed to go, for fear of the violent inmates, a red-haired woman blocked his way. If her plain cotton gown hadn't marked her as a resident, the wildness of her eyes would have declared it well enough. There were red stripes on her skin where restraints were sometimes placed, and her feet were bare, leaving moist, sweaty prints on the black and white tiles.
Madeline?
Madeline, it's time to return to your room.
But Madeline's eyes were locked on the automaton.
What's that?
She didn't budge, even when the doctor took her arm and signaled quietly for an orderly.
His name is Ted. I made him.
Ted. Ted for now.
What?
Edwin finally noticed that Ted had stopped marching and that Ted's metal face was gazing up at Madeline. The clockwork boy had wound itself down, or maybe it was only listening.
He's your Ted for now, but you must watch him. Such empty children are vulnerable.
Miss, he's only a machine.
Yes, but he's your boy, and he has no soul. There are things who would change that, and change it badly.
I know I shouldn't take him upstairs. I know I ought to keep him away from the other boys.
Not what I mean, boy. Invisible things. Bad little souls that need bodies.
An orderly arrived. He was a big square man with shoulders like an ox's yoke. His uniform was white except for a streak of blood that was drying to brown. He took Madeline by one arm, more roughly than he needed to. As Madeline was pulled away, back to her room, or back to her restraints, she kept her eyes on Edwin and Ted.
keep him close, unless you want him stolen from you, unless you want his clockwork heart replaced with something stranger.
Before she was removed from the corridor altogether, she lashed out one last time with her one free hand to seize the wall's corner. It brought her another few seconds of eye contact.
Watch him close.
Then she was gone. Edwin reached for Ted and pulled the automaton to his chest.
I will. I'll watch him close.
Several days passed quietly, except for the occasional frustrated rages of the senile doctor, and Ted's company was a welcome diversion, if a somewhat unusual one. Though Edwin had designed Ted's insides and stuffed the gears and coils himself, the automaton's behavior was not altogether predictable. Mostly, Ted remained a quiet little toy with the marching feet that tripped at stairs, at shoes, or any other obstacle left on the floor. And if the clockwork character fell, it fell like a turtle and laid where it collapsed, arms and legs twitching impotently at the air until Edwin would come and set his friend upright. Several times Edwin unhooked Ted's back panel, wondering precisely why the shutoff switch failed so often, but he never found any stretched spring or faulty coil to account for it. If he asked Ted, purely to speculate aloud, Ted's shiny jaw would lower and lift. But sometimes, if Edwin listened very hard, he could almost convince himself he heard words rattling around inside Ted's chest. Even if it was only the sound of metal on metal, the boy's eager ears would concentrate and listen for whispers. Once, he was nearly certain, practically positive, that Ted had said its own name. And that was silly, wasn't it? No matter how much Edwin wanted to believe, he knew better, which did not stop him from wondering. It was always Edwin's job to bring meals down from the kitchen, and every time he climbed the stairs, he made a point to secure Ted by turning it off and leaving it lying on its back, on Edwin's cot. The doctor was doddering, and even unobstructed, he sometimes stumbled on his own 2 feet or the laces of his shoes. So when the boy went for breakfast and returned to the laboratory with a pair of steaming meals on a covered tray, he was dismayed to hear Ted activated.
Ted? Doctor? Doctor, are you looking at Ted? You remember him, don't you? Please don't break him.
At the bottom of the stairs, Dr. Smeeks was crouched over the prone and kicking Ted, poking at it with a pencil like a boy prods an anthill.
Underfoot this thing is. Did it on purpose. I saw it. Turned itself on, sat itself up, and here it comes.
Sir, I turned him off, and I'm sorry if he turned himself on again. I'm not sure why it happens.
Because it wants to be on. It wants to make me fall. It practically told me so.
Ted can't talk.
He can. You may not hear him, but I can. I've heard him before. And he used to say pleasant things. He used to hum his name. Now he fusses and mutters like a demented old man. Yes, this thing, when it mutters, it sounds like me.
Sir, he hasn't got any lungs or a tongue. I promise, he can't speak.
He cannot flip his own switches either, yet he does.
Edwin retrieved his friend and set it back on its feet.
I must have done something wrong when I built him. I'll try and fix it, sir. I'll make him stop it.
Dear boy, I don't believe you can. Something smells good. Did you get breakfast?
Yes, sir. Eggs and grits with sausage.
Ooh, wonderful. Won't you join me here? I'll clear you a spot.
As the old man did so, Edwin moved the tray to the open space on the main laboratory table and removed the tray's lid, revealing 2 sets of silverware and 2 plates loaded with food. He set one in front of the doctor and took one for himself. As they ate, it seemed like Dr. Smeeks had already forgotten about his complaint with Ted. As for Ted, the automaton stood still at the foot of the stairs, its face cocked at an angle that suggested it might be listening, or watching, or paying attention to something that no one else could see. Edwin wouldn't have liked to admit it, but when he glanced back at his friend, he felt a pang of unease. Nothing had changed, and everything was fine. He was letting the doctor's rattled mood unsettle him, that was all. Nothing had changed, and everything was fine. But Ted was not marching, and its arms were not swaying, and the switch behind the machine's small shoulder was still set in the on position. When the meal was finished and Edwin had gathered the empty plates to return them upstairs, he stopped by Ted and flipped the switch to the off position.
You must have run down your winding. That must be why you stopped moving. Doctor, I'm running upstairs to give these to Mrs. Criddle. I've turned Ted off, so he shouldn't bother you, but keep an eye out just in case. Maybe if you wanted to, you could open him up yourself and see if you can't fix him.
Dr. Smeeks didn't answer, and Edwin left him alone, only for a few minutes, only long enough to return the tray with its plates and cutlery. It was long enough to return to strangeness. Back in the laboratory, Edwin found the doctor backed into a corner, holding a screwdriver and a large pair of scissors. Ted was seated on the edge of the laboratory table, its legs dangling over the side, unmoving, unmarching. The doctor looked alert and lucid, more so than usual, and he did not quite look afraid. Shadows from the burners and beakers with their tiny glowing creatures made Dr. Smeeks look sinister and defensive, for the flickering bits of flame winked reflections off the edge of his scissors.
Doctor?
I was only going to fix him, like you said.
Doctor, it's all right.
No, I don't believe it is all right. Not at all. That nasty little thing, Parker, I don't like it.
But he's my friend.
He's no friend of mine.
Dr. Smeeks, I'll take him. I'll fix him. You don't have to do it. He's only a machine, you know, just an invention. He can't hurt you.
He tried.
Sir, I really don't think...
He tried to bite me. Could have taken my fingers off if I'd caught them in that bear trap of a face. You keep it away from me, Edwin. Keep it away or I'll pull it apart and turn it into a can opener.
Before Edwin's very own eyes, Ted's head turned until the machine fully faced the doctor. And if its eyes had been more than glass bits that were once assigned to a badger, then they might have narrowed or gleamed. But they were only glass bits, and they only cast back the fragments of light from the bright things in the laboratory. Edwin gently pulled the automaton down from the table.
Ted, come with me. No one's going to turn you into a can opener. Maybe you got wound funny or too tight. I'll open you up and tinker. You'll be just fine.
Back in the corner, the doctor seemed to relax.
Edwin? Edwin, did we finish breakfast? I don't see my plate.
Yes, sir.
Oh, I suppose that's right.
Edwin stuck Ted down firmly between the wall and his cot, and for one crazy moment he considered binding the machine's feet with twine or wire to keep it from wandering. But the thought drifted out of his head, chased away by the unresponsive lump against the wall.
I don't know how you're doing it, but you need to stop. I don't want the doctor to turn you into a can opener.
Then, as a compromise to his thoughts about hobbling the automaton, he dropped his blanket over the thing's head. Bedtime was awkward that night. When Edwin reached for the clockwork boy, he remembered the slow, calculated turn of the machine's head, and he recalled the blinking bright flashes of firelight in the glass badger eyes. The doctor had settled in his nook and was sleeping, but Edwin was still awake. He reclaimed his blanket and settled down on his side, facing the wall and Ted until he dozed. He must have dozed. He must have been dreaming to have imagined the sounds he vaguely heard.
Ted? Ted?
No, tango foot.
Edwin closed his eyes and was surprised to learn that they had not been closed already. He tugged his blanket up under his chin.
I must be asleep.
And then, eventually, he was. Though not for long, Edwin slept poorly. He was too warm and then too cold, and then something was missing. Through the halls of his nightmares, mechanical feet marched to their own tune. In the confined and cluttered space of the laboratory, there was movement too large to come from rats, and too deliberate to be the random flipping of a switch. Edwin awakened and sat upright in the same moment, with the same fluid fear propelling both events. There was no reason for it, or so he told himself, and this was ridiculous. It was only the old Dr. Smeeks and his slipping mind, infecting the boy with strange stories, turning the child against his only true friend. Edwin shot his fingers over to the wall where Ted ought to be jammed, waiting to be wound and turned on, and he felt only the smooth, faintly damp texture of the painted stone. His hands flapped and flailed, slapping at the emptiness and the flat blank wall.
Ted? Ted?
From his bed in the nook at the other end of the laboratory, the doctor answered.
Parker?
Yes, sir? Sir, there's...
What is it, son?
Edwin untangled himself from the sheets and toppled to the floor. He stopped his fall with his hands and stood,
but then could scarcely walk. As a matter of necessity, he dropped his bottom on the edge of the cot and felt for his feet, where something tight was cinched around his ankles. There, he found a length of wire bent into a loop and secured. It hobbled his legs together, cutting his stride in half.
Parker? Boy?
Sir, stay where you are, unless you have a light. My friend, Ted, he's gotten loose again. I don't want you to hurt yourself.
I can't find my candle.
I can't find mine either. You stay there. I'll come to you.
The boy had no idea where his automaton had gone. Even the blue-gold shadows cast by the shimmering solutions did not reveal the clockwork boy. Edwin struggled with the bizarre bind on his legs and stumbled forward regardless of it. No matter how hard his fingers twisted and pulled, the wires only dug into his skin and cut it when he yanked too sharply. He gave up and stepped as wide as he could and found that, if he was careful, he could still walk and even, in half hops and uneven staggers, he could run. His light was nowhere to be found, and he gave up on that, too.
Sir, I'm coming!
Edwin remembered the red-haired Madeline with the strap marks on her wrists. She'd said Ted had no soul, but she'd implied that one might come along. The darkness baffled him, even in the laboratory he knew by heart. Hobbled as he was and terrified by the pattering of unnatural feet, the basement's windowless night worked against him and he panicked. He needed help, but where could it come from? The orderlies upstairs frightened him in a vague way, and the doctors and nurses might think he was as crazy as the other children, wild and loud, or as mad as his mother. Like Madeline. Her name tinkled at the edge of his ears, or through the nightmare confusion that moved him in jilting circles. Maybe Madeline knew something he didn't. Maybe she could help. She wouldn't make fun of him at any rate. She wouldn't tell him he was frightened for nothing and go back to sleep. He knew approximately where her room was located. He found it easier to manage the stairs using his hands to climb. Edwin knocked his knees against each angle and bruised his shins with every yard. Along the wall above him, there was a handrail someplace, but he couldn't find it, so he made do without it. He crawled so fast that his ascent might have been called a scramble. He hated to leave the doctor alone down there with Ted, but then again, the doctor had taken up the screwdriver and the scissors once before. Perhaps he could be trusted to defend himself again. At the top of the stairs, Edwin found more light and his eyes were relieved. He stood up, seized the handrail, and fell forward because he'd already forgotten about the wire wrapped around his ankles. His hands stung from hitting the tile floor. But he picked himself up and began a shuffling run, in tiny skips and dragging leaps down the corridor. A gurney loomed skeletal and shining in the ambient light from the windows and the moon outside. Edwin fell past it and clipped it with his shoulder. He continued down the hallway, past the nurse's station where an elderly woman was asleep with the most recent issue of Harper's New Monthly magazine lying across her breasts. She didn't budge, not even when the gurney rolled into the center of the hallway, following in Edwin's wake. When he reached the right wing, he paused.
Madeline! Madeline, can you hear me?
All the windows and the doors to the inmate rooms were well off the ground, and Edwin wasn't tall enough to reach, so he couldn't see inside.
Madeline? Madeline! Madeline!
He went from door to door, and eventually she came forward, her hands wrapped around the bars at the top, coiling around them like small white snakes. She held her face up to the small window.
Boy?
Edwin dashed to the door and pushed himself against it.
Madeline, it's me!
You're back.
Edwin stood on his tiptoes also, but he couldn't touch the window high above his head.
I need your help. Something's wrong with Ted.
Not your Ted any longer. I warned you.
I know you did. I need your help. He tied my feet together, all tangled up. And I think he's trying to hurt Dr. Smeeks.
Tangle, did he? Oh, that vicious little changeling. You must let me out, little boy. I know what to do with changelings.
It was unwise to let her out, Edwin knew. But when he looked back over his shoulder at the nurse's station with the old lady sleeping within, and when he thought of the automaton roaming the laboratory darkness with his dear Dr. Smeeks, he leapt at the prospect of aid. He reached for the lever to open the door and hung from it, letting it hold his full weight while he reached up to undo the lock. As soon as the fastener unlatched, the door burst open in a quick swing that knocked him off his hobbled feet. With a smarting head and bruised elbow, he fought to stand again. But Madeline grabbed him by the shoulder. She lifted him up as if he were as light as a doll, and she lugged him down the hallway. Her dingy cotton shift billowed behind her as she ran. She reached the top of the stairs and flung herself down them. Edwin banged along behind her, twisted in her grip, and unable to move quickly even if she were to set him down. He wondered if he hadn't made an awful mistake when she all but cast him aside. His body flopped gracelessly against a wall. But he was back on his feet in a moment, and there was light in the laboratory, a flickering uncertain light that was moving like mad. Dr. Smeeks was holding it. He'd found his light after all, and he'd raised the wick on the hurricane lamp. The glass-jarred lantern gleamed and flashed as he swung it back and forth, sweeping the floor for something Edwin couldn't see.
Parker! Parker! Something's here! Something's in the laboratory!
I know, sir! But I've brought help!
The light shifted, the hurricane lamp swung, and Madeline was standing in front of the doctor, a blazing figure doused in gold and red and black-edged shadows. Without preamble, she shoved the doctor's wrist up, forcing the lamp higher. The illumination increased accordingly. The laboratory was in such disarray that it might never be restored to order. Glass glimmered in piles of dust, shattered tubes and broken beakers were smeared with the shining residue of the blue-green substance that lived and glowed in the dark. It spilled and died, losing its luminescence with every passing second. And there was the doctor, his hand held aloft, and his lamp bathing the chaos with revelation. Madeline turned away from him, standing close enough beneath the lamp so that her shadow did not temper its light. Her feet twisted on the glass-littered floor, cutting her toes and leaving smears of blood.
Where are you?
Tangles, tangles, feet, Tanglefoot.
That's your name then? Little changeling, little Tanglefoot? Come out here! Come out here and I'll send you back to where you came from. Shame on you taking a boy's friend. Shame on you binding his feet and tormenting his master.
Can't open her.
Ted, where are you?
Tearing his eyes away from Madeline, Edwin scanned the room.
Madeline, they're coming for you!
And I'm coming for him!
Madeline spied the automaton in the same second that Edwin saw it. Not on the ground, but overhead, on a ledge where the doctor kept books. Tanglefoot was marching, yes, but it was marching towards them both, clutching the doctor's enormous scissors.
Ted!
The machine hesitated. The boy did not know why, but there was much he did not know, and there were many things he'd never understand. The madwoman seized the doctor's hurricane lamp, ignoring the burning of her hands. She flung the oil-filled lamp at the oncoming machine with the glittering badger eyes. The lamp shattered, and the room was flooded with brilliance and burning. Sparks flew onto Dr. Smeeks, starting to burn his hair and nightshirt, but Edwin was there, shuffling fast into the doctor's sleeping nook. The boy grabbed the top blanket and covered the doctor. Then he went to work, smothering the flames on the old man. When the last spark had been extinguished, Edwin held the doctor in the corner, hugging the frail, quivering man against himself while Madeline went to war. Tanglefoot was spinning in place from his fiery perch on the book ledge. Madeline's hair was singed and her shift was popped with black-edged holes. She grabbed the asbestos gloves Dr. Smeeks used when he held his crucibles. Someone in a uniform reached the bottom of the stairs and was repulsed, repelled by the blast of fire.
Water! We need water down here!
The orderly retreated back up the stairs, but Madeline's focus on the battle never wavered. Tanglefoot's scissors fell to the ground, flung from its distracted hands. The smoldering handles were melting on the floor, making a black sticky puddle where they settled. With her gloved hands, she scooped them up and stabbed, shoving the blades repeatedly down into the burning metal body of Ted until its kicking ceased. Then she jerked Ted down off the ledge and flung it to the floor. The fire ate at the books and gnawed at the ends of the tables.
Bring me a blanket!
Reluctantly, Edwin uncovered the shrouded doctor. He wadded the blanket between his hands and threw it to Madeline. She caught it and unwrapped it enough to flap it down atop the machine. Then she beat it again and again, smothering the fire as she struck the mechanical boy. Something broke beneath the blanket, and the chewing tongues of flame devoured the cloth that covered Tanglefoot's joints, leaving only a tragic frame beneath the smoldering covers. Suddenly, a bucket of cold water doused Madeline from behind. Seconds later, she was seized, and her hands were held behind her back.
Don't! No, you can't! No, she was only trying to help! No, no, you can't take her away! Don't hurt her, please! It's my fault!
Dr. Simmons was there. Edwin didn't know when he'd arrived, preparing to administer an ether-dampened washcloth to Madeline's face.
I don't know how she escaped this time.
I did it!
The boy's as loony as his mother. The clockwork boy. It called me, and I destroyed it. I let myself out. Didn't you know that I'm a witch? I'm every bit the fiend you thought I must be.
And she might have gone on, but the drug dragged her into unconsciousness. She sagged as she was hauled away.
No! It isn't fair! Don't hurt her!
No one was listening to him. Not Dr. Smeeks huddled in a corner, not Madeline unconscious and being lugged back to her room, and not the bundle of burned and smashed parts in a pile beneath the book ledge under a smoldering wool blanket. Edwin tried to sift through the detritus of Ted, but it was useless. Nothing moved, and nothing grumbled with malice in the disassembled stack of ash-smeared plates, gears, and screws. Edwin returned to the doctor and climbed up against him. Dr. Smeeks wrapped his arms around the boy.
There, there, Parker. It's only a little fire. I must have let the crucible heat too long. But look, it's almost out now. We'll be fine.
The Clockwork Century, Book One, Bone Shaker. In the early days of the Civil War, rumors of gold in the frozen Klondike brought hordes of newcomers to the Pacific Northwest. Anxious to compete, Russian prospectors commissioned inventor Leviticus Blue to create a great machine that could mine through Alaska's ice. Thus was Dr. Blue's incredible bone-shaking drill engine born. But on its first test run, the bone shaker went terribly awry, destroying several blocks of downtown Seattle and unearthing a subterranean vein of blight gas that turned anyone who breathed it into the living dead. Now, it is 16 years later, and a wall has been built to enclose the devastated and toxic city. Just beyond it lives Blue's widow, Briar Wilkes. Life is hard with a ruined reputation and a teenage boy to support, but she and Ezekiel are managing. Until Ezekiel undertakes a secret crusade to rewrite history. His quest will take him under the wall and into a city teeming with ravenous undead, air pirates, criminal overlords, and heavily armed refugees. And only Briar can bring him out alive. The Clockwork Century, Tanglefoot, is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2008 by Sherry Priest. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2014, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Unauthorized download and or duplication is prohibited. Performed by Colleen Delaney, Matthew Bassett, Christopher Graybill, Gabriella Fernandez-Coffey, Helen Pafumi, Andy Clements, Evan Casey, and Bradley Smith. Directed by Colleen Delaney. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing, graphic audio sound design, and original music by Thomas Hogan. Story adapted for graphic audio by Doug Krenslin. The Clockwork Century theme was composed by Thomas Hogan. If you enjoyed The Clockwork Century Tanglefoot, be sure to look for The Clockwork Century Book 1, Bone Shaker. Available soon at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloads and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other exciting titles in Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can select from over 900 titles and 60 series in either CD or high-quality download formats. If you would like to listen to an entire series, you can conveniently purchase the whole sets on CD or USB flash drive from graphicaudio.net. At graphicaudio.net, you can now earn loyalty rewards points, redeemable toward future online purchases. You can also get full mobile downloads directly to your phone or tablet with our new Graphic Audio Access app, available on all Android and Apple devices, so you can listen on the go, anytime, anywhere. Call 1-800-670-5220 or visit www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our email newsletter, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter.